Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
And welcome. Professor Val here, waiting for Dr. Mark. Not sure where he is, but I'm sure he'll be popping in shortly. I think our guest might be here already, too, beating Dr. Mark. So hang on if that's you there. We have to wait a little while for Dr. Mark to get here. In the meanwhile, I have been getting these emails from the Urban Dictionary, and every day there's like a slang word of the day. So this week there were a couple of good ones. I figured I would share them with you. Let's see here. Hold on. All right, here it is. All right. Today's word was recessionista, which is a person who is able to stick to a tight budget while still managing to dress stylishly. So in days of our recession here, I think that one was pretty appropriate. And yesterday's word was actually even better. Nonversation, a completely worthless conversation where nothing is illuminated, explained, or otherwise elaborated upon. Typically occurs at parties, bars, or other events where meaningful conversation is nearly impossible. I loved it. And several of our conversations even here are non-versations from time to time. And let's see, what else did we have this week that was good? All right, everybody is messaging me. I'm trying to do some work here. All right. Lehman Sisters. Wives, girlfriends of recently orphaned Lehman Brothers executives who bond to share their collective unexpected fall down the socioeconomic ladder. Not a bad one. And what else did we have this week that was pretty good? Let's see. Hold on a second. Let me pop Dr. Mark up here while I'm... nice of you to show up.
And hello!
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Wait, I have to do one more Urban Dictionary word here. You can wait a second, right?
Well, I'm missing 2 minutes.
That's right. Let's see. Bad economy, an all-purpose excuse that people use during a recession to justify doing things that are below their usual standard. Often these things, in reality, have little or nothing to do with the economic circumstances. So the example that they give is, Harry says, "You took your girlfriend to Applebee's on Valentine's Day? Pretty weak." And Larry says, "Whatever, man, I didn't have a choice. Bad economy."
Hey, how you doing? Well, we're going to take a little tour of the facility. Pandorama of fun over there at the Buffalo Wild Wings tonight as the sports rant continues here in New Rochelle. And my Pal Talk buddies were there. Harlem 17.
Really?
And Untouchable and... there was a dude from Yonkers that recognized me as Summer Boy. So,
did you have fun?
Fun? I'm still there, believe me. The chick from Coors Light was giving out free beer. Free beer, she kept saying. And I kept saying, right here. Yeah, I got myself a Met t-shirt. I got some more of the Big Nut bars. So I'm well stoked for the evening.
Didn't you, half choke to death on one of those?
Yeah, on the air, a couple weeks ago.
Well,
yeah.
Please don't do that again.
I will refrain. I will just nurse myself with the Snapple during the show.
Yes, that's
right. We have things to do. We have all kinds of things. We have a special guest tonight. This guy's, like pretty famous. So.
Well, I see somebody is already here and was
really?
Here before you.
Really? Already here? All right.
Yeah.
Well, could you just retheme me here while I get ready here?
I shouldn't.
I know. I know the karma of the ego. I know.
Let me see. If I can even
come on, I'm fresh from freaking Springfield, which
oh,
you know was
bite me.
Was very beneficial to my psyche.
Yeah. All right, I'm looking. I don't know what you put it under here.
What, theme song? Wasp something. I'll be back.
Wasp 26. I got it.
That's it.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
We are.
Now listen to this. I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with raw iron soul.
All right, day on, 9:05. Summertime has arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, wait, I didn't even sign into this dopey thing yet. Okay, let's see. Nikitsoma. Yeah, meeting all these radio sapes, and I actually was called a yapster tonight for the first time, which was very, pleasing.
You are a yapster.
I'm a yapster. So one guy said, Greg Giannotti, my man Pots and Pans is what he called me. Yeah, because I did a rant for the Big Nut bars to get my earn my Big Nut bars.
Oh God!
And apparently it was well received by the audience because they replayed it, and the crowd went wild. The Buffalo Wild Wings. I could. Why do I have to walk away from such a pleasing environment?
You know? You didn't have to. You could have just called and we could have
begged the show and said, "I'm having fun. Goodbye."
Well, for the amount of times during the year you actually are having fun, I think that you would be entitled.
Duty calls.
Bring the cell phone and do it from there.
Sure. Sure. Tell me now. Tell me now, Eco. Where am I?
Well,
what is this thing doing to me? Oh, here we go. My Blog Talk and then all right. So any news from Ass Book? Anybody have a party and take pictures of women under the age of 18 or some anything interesting like that?
No, but one of my former students said that we need to get on Oprah with your stuff.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm gonna kind of usher in the spring because this is the first show we are doing officially in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
With a little song I posted on Facebook that nobody's commented on yet, which I'm very disappointed. It's like
I didn't see
reaction.
It.
Really, nobody looks. Well, anyway.
That front page is there, and I'm on it quite often, and I saw nothing.
Well, I'll tell you the inspiration of this was quickly. A guy by the name of Rick Parr, psychologist, was at the CAS conference last week. And he gave a talk about the universe and about this whole idea that all we do as conscious beings, basically, is reject, invalidate, and somehow negate things in order to know something. In order to establish meaning, you have to say something matters over something doesn't matter. So knowing, K-N-O-W, is real about saying no. Ontoing, basically, as he learned over the weekend. And he's a flaming eco like me. So he gave a 6-minute talk because he didn't plan on giving a talk, because he didn't even plan on being there. He just kind of fell in the room like an eco like it is. And in 6 minutes, he had this crowd of PhDs doubting there was a table in front of them, there was a chair under their asses, and they stood there astonished. And all he said at the end was, which is really funny, he pointed at me, he goes, such is Eco. It was perfect.
Nice.
And so here's a little song dedicated to him from the movie Eurotrip. I give you this.
Hey, listen up, everybody. Got a little special thing I'd like to do tonight. Play a little song for you about the nastiest, freakiest little sex puppet I know, Fiona. This one's for you, baby. Happy anniversary.
Fiona's got a mom phone. Yes, I am not alone.
This band rocks!
There you go.
The band Lustra, ladies and gentlemen, ushering in the spring here on Summertime.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now we got to get 180 degrees from that element and get all serious about the topic of the evening, which is dealing with kind of a funky thing in Summerland, self-esteem. So joining us from an undisclosed location in the Northeast, we have Dr. Joe Rubino, author of at least 10 books on
all right,
this topic.
I will get the diving horn.
Oh, diving horn. Okay, I will get the muted call thing. Okay.
All right, you ready?
From the Center of Personal Reinvention.com. You can remember all that. You can see it over on the site. Dr. Joe, you there?
I am, Dr.
Okay, don't be alarmed. That's just the summer submarine pulling away from the dock as we delve and spelunk the consciousness of the listeners tonight.
I was wondering what it was.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of surprises here, believe me. If you just tuned in with the Scotty Doesn't Know stuff, I mean, it's been one of those Wednesdays. So, right off the bat, you have an offer for the listeners. If they just tuned in, why don't you just give us a skinny on what they can do while they're listening or right after the show to take advantage of your work?
Well, sure. Just for checking out the work that we do to help people elevate their self-esteem, if you go to www.selfesteemsystem.com, you will receive a 45-minute audio called 7 Steps to Soaring Self-Esteem, as well as a free membership in what we call the Success Achievers Club, which has a self-esteem mini course. It has personal development, e-books and audios and articles and tips and discounts and free offers and all sorts of good stuff to have you to live your best life and be the best you can be.
Okay. Well, we're going to repeat that again before we get off the air, so if you missed it, we'll say it again because you want to get into the essential sort of beef we have with the whole self-esteem industry and self-help in and of itself as a part from that, because there's a lot of layers to this, as you know, if you've been in the industry. Now, one of the things I got to say, reading your bio, this is one of the things that came up in our little prep for the show, is your degree says DMD. Now, where I come from, that means dentist.
Well, it means dentist where I come from, too.
Okay, good. So how do we...
dentist. Should I tell you my story?
Yeah, please.
We have to hear this.
This is like behind the music here.
Yeah, I was a dentist practicing for 18 years, and although I had a very successful practice, lots of patients, 2 offices, 7 doctors working in my practice, something was missing. I had this intuitive feeling that there was something more out there. But the problem was I was an extreme introvert at the time, didn't public speak, didn't socialize much. But I had this sense that there was something more. I didn't know I could write at the time. And so, long story short, I entered into a process of personal development, reinvented myself, and then formed the Center for Personal Reinvention to support other people to reinvent whatever it is that doesn't support them about their lives and themselves. And, of course, self-esteem is a great part of that because we all, at least most of us, might. And since 1991, I've coached more than 1,000 people personally. And the one thread that goes through all the suffering and the poverty and the lack of belief in themselves and the low socioeconomic status and all that bad stuff we don't want is lacking self-esteem. So what I decided to do was support people to really champion them to make their lives work optimally in all 6 areas and live their best lives.
Well, because this is a remarkable story because, as you know, dentists have, like, one of the biggest rates of suicide in the country. have you pulled many dentists from this river of despair?
Well, actually, yeah, I work with a lot of dentists. And
imagine, you'd be a hero among them because, you know, my dentist is, see, now we get into our work a little bit as we go through. So you would be in the, in our parlance, the way your brain developed, the way you developed a... sort of a style of living, you would be what we call an eco, which means you're emotionally intelligent, you're empathic, you understand that life is not perfect, and you try to make the best of things, and it's that mercurial aspect of you that makes you someone who could be a resource for someone that's dealing with, you know, that comeback from you know, the depths of despair kind of thing, where other people don't understand it. When someone gets depressed, they actually polarize to them, and they'll exclude them. The eco-consciousness is like, I get it, things don't go right, I get it, things go up and down. And most dentists that I know, especially one I have here in town, have a completely different worldview, and their mindset is much more exosomatic. So basically, they're sort of divorced from affect and interiority and felt sense awareness, and they're much more practical and task-oriented. That's why drill, drill, drill. So I talk about Sarah Palin there for a second. So they don't get very high, they don't get very low. So they're kind of like, they're like the garbage barge on the river, you know, they're just kind of And their deal is that as long as they're doing something, they're useful. The minute they're not doing something, they feel a little bit useless, and that's why they get so depressed, and the job is sort of, you know, you're dealing with people in pain, suffering, things like that. So how long did you actually practice?
18 years.
Like me. I'm 18 years into this chiropractic thing. Yeah. Now, this is one of the things. You found personal development and all this stuff with self-esteem through the introspection you gained in practicing dentistry. And I found somatics in the chiropractic realm because I realized, maybe this is something you can clarify for me, the more you worked on yourself early on and realized that you can help a heck of a lot more people maybe experience more than just dental bliss if you can elevate their awareness of what their actual worth is. Now, make a distinction for me before we get to some of the questions. Self-esteem versus self-worth. What is your distinction between the two of those things?
Well, the self-worth and self-esteem are very closely related, but self-esteem for me really is about two different areas. First, it has four different qualities, and true self-esteem is about personal power. It's about our ability to influence others. It's also about significance, which means our ability to be accepted and have the attention and the affection of other people. It's about virtue, feeling good about who we are morally, so we don't go around thinking we're a jerk and we're ashamed of things that we do and the person that we are. And it also is about confidence, which is our ability to produce a result and be in control of our lives. And that confidence extends to all six areas of life. So our health and appearance, our wealth and our finances, our business or our occupation, personal and spiritual development areas, our family and other relationships in the area of recreating, having fun, and pursuing our passions. So it's a lot more in-depth than just self-worth, because self-esteem also involves an appreciation for what it's like in the other guy's world, as opposed to just ego, which is about ourselves. And so self-worth is about us. Self-esteem is about both us and other people. And we can't have an appreciation for what it's like in the other person's world and without having high self-esteem. If we're only concerned about ourselves, then by my definition, we don't have high self-esteem.
Okay, because a lot of people are laying on a couch that Val might be near, as a shrinkatologist, trying to wrestle with that very riddle, is that the lion's share of people judge their self-worth by how other people judge them. And they say, I'm only as good as they say I am, whether it's my boss, my spouse, my family, my community, whatever it is. How do you get them out of that map to get them to go and say, no, you establish the standard and let the other people either rise to that standard or stay where they are and free them up?
Well, you know, that's really the problem that the world goes through. we all have it that we're only as good as the feedback that we get. But the problem is we're constantly getting negative feedback. And what that does is it has us be at the effect of whatever other people say and do. So we're constantly in a reactive mode. And we're constantly run by one of three predominant emotions. Anger, for most people. And for many, it's sadness, which looks like that low-grade depression or being dead that you kind of referred to, you know, that that kind of equanimity or lack of highs and lows. Well, that's resignation for the most part, where people just give up. And so they lose the passion and they just feel like this is all there is and that's just who I am and there's nothing much I can do about it. So the bottom line is that that's a lie. And if you're driven by any of those three, fear, sadness, or anger, you're constantly in that reactive mode where you're depending upon the approval of other people. You're depending upon positive feedback. You're constantly invalidating yourself or you're allowing other people to invalidate you. And that's just a trap door. It's a downward spiral that, you know, there's no gold there at all. So,
So let me just give you a kind of a crossover, because we interviewed Heather Pickett last, was it last week? Week before?
I think it was the week before.
Week before. They're all running together here. And she wrote a book, I mean, maybe you've tapped into this, this law of attraction stuff that we absolutely cannot stand on this show. We beat it to death.
That's right.
And because it doesn't allow for things to be released. And it basically puts the person in a position where everything that happens to them has something to do with some unconscious, subconscious, or other than conscious thought that they may or may not have had, maybe at some time in a past life, and it almost reverses the power mirror. So the things that you're telling us is that, again, this is dealing with negativity, positivity, all these negative emotions that we have, which I feel have a context. It's what people do once they're in that position. We say sometimes that you don't get angry, angry gets you. And if you understand the cues of it, from a physiological standpoint, the breathing cadence, the way you walk, the way you hold tension in your body, the way you kind of internalize a lot of your standards about the way people are supposed to treat you, your personal space. I was just over at Wild Wings. Someone was crowding me. I said, back up. And it was like the anger came up. I said, oh, wow, that was weird. Someone got in my personal space, and I reacted like a junkyard dog. And I realized that all these things are subtle, yet they all add up to something that's very obvious, which is that survival is not something to be ashamed of. And most people that experience negative emotions on a regular basis, they're living in survival. Some of them are languishing in survival. So they take a lot of drugs. They take a lot of over-the-counter, under-the-counter, around-the-counter type of medication, self-medicate with TV, all kinds of soft addictions. What do you say to them listening that say, you know what, I got a completely plausible, get-out-of-my-jail-free card, reason for being angry, upset, depressed, whatever, and I'm going to claim it because that's the only thing that's between me and, you know, the next step down the food chain?
Well, first of all, anger is very powerful. It gives us a false sense of power. It has us feel like we can dominate others and avoid being dominated by them. It also gives us a justification for doing things that we wouldn't do if we weren't angry. And it really allows us to exert control where we feel like we have none. Now, the thing about anger is that it's an incredibly addictive emotion. It's stronger than heroin in that people are so addicted to their emotional mood of anger that what happens is it's absolutely what you just said. It's tied into survival. We do the best we can, and anger is the trigger that has us say, hey, you know, my personal space is threatened, my life is threatened, my safety, my sanity, whatever that is, so back off. So I can be powerful, like you said, get away from me, because the anger gets triggered. Now, the problem is that most people are just automatic with one of these three emotions, anger, sadness, which for many people looks like that low-grade depression, or fear, which looks like worry. So you know people that go around worrying about everything all the time. And what happens is that the emotions run them. They're not aware that their lives are being dictated by these emotions. So I'll give you an example. You're in the bar. Somebody gets close to you. You say, hey, back off, buddy, because, you know, you're invading my space. Well, you're protecting yourself. But what if that person was there to contribute something to you? Maybe that person was giving out $1,000 bills and wanted to come up and give one to you, just as a bad example that comes right off the top of my head. But you just, you know, threw them away. You just pushed them away. You just, your anger got the most of you because you didn't have the ability to take a break between your reaction and your emotion. So you reacted first and you thought about it second. Now, what happens to us in real life is that so many of us are addicted to anger that we react first, we think second, and we ruin our relationships, we damage our health, we sacrifice our personal effectiveness, we give up all the things that we really want because the anger does not allow us to be in choice in how we respond to a situation, but instead it has us be that knee-jerk reaction that we're in that whole survival mode. So the whole secret to living the upset-free life is to first catch the anger, catch the emotion before you need to react.
When is anger in context, then? When is it appropriate to be, again, this is a state. This is not something that's an attitude or a mood or a physiological state. You hit yourself with a thumb with a hammer or something like that, and you go, man, and you have a reaction. What we try to teach our people listening to is that there's two dimensions of time that no one talks about. One is the moment, which doesn't have a duration, and the other one is chronological, which has a rhythm. So how do you get people to be aware of where to place that awareness when they have a moment when they're about to lose? Like you said, the whole thing, probably back in the 70s now. Oh, count to 10, things like that. Oh, you know, grab one of those funny pillows and displace it. The physical tension that anger commands, because like you're saying, it's an alarm state. It's the first state of the general adaptive syndrome when you're dealing with stress. It's something that takes over. Like I said, it is a drug. It's a biochemical drug that comes from your body. To deny it, to repress it, to put it away, or to make it something polarized to only gives it more power over you, from a bodily standpoint. So how do you approach that when someone's trying to get their self-esteem back? And you said anger makes them feel powerful. Anger makes them feel competent. Anger makes them feel capable. Maybe, and again, I'm searching from your side of the coin, where does the context come in? Maybe there's a context where getting mad, like I talked about with a client last week about she lost 75 pounds in a couple of months. She finally got to the threshold where she got mad at her weight, and that caused her to diet. So when is anger actually a fuel rather than something that is to be feared like fire?
Well, anger has its value. You know, someone is you're in your front yard and you see out of the corner of your eye someone is pulling up to the curb and abducting your child. Well, you know, it's good to be angry there because the anger will fuel you to get to the curb and to save your child and to, you know,
right.
beat up the guy who's
yeah.
trying to cause the child harm. So anger has its purpose. You know, it can motivate you to action. But the thing that it doesn't serve you is when it runs you, when you're not in control of that anger, but it is in control of you so that you now damage relationships. Or, you know, you get angry at the least provocation so that it starts to have health challenges. You know, your blood pressure goes up. You have heart problems. You damage your relationships. So whenever...
Right. Well, that's staying there too long. The rule of thumb is 5 minutes of angry gets you about 8 hours of suppressed immune function. So think about people driving to work every day, road rage, whatever. Half-hour commute, they're angry for half of it. I mean, they're shut off for 24 hours. Combine that 5 days a week, do that 50 weeks a year, you wonder why people's immune systems are falling apart. So, yeah, my thing is that is about this is that, you know, to deny it, its context almost sort of rips the person out of their biological roots and says, never, never, never get angry. And that makes them feel a little bit like they're not really in their body anymore. They have to be in this mindset all the time. And so... what I would agree with you with is that you cannot build a positive, lasting self-esteem being angry all the time.
Yep.
And what most people do is they try to fight their emotions rather than work with them and fuel them and read them. And you're saying recognize them. Recognize them for what they are. They're just survival cues. They're left over from, you know, eons of evolution. And your job is to sort of not so much try to deny them or put them away, but to put them in their proper context and realize that they're only there for the moment to wake you up. Like you said, when there is a cue, when there is a situation that comes up, and then to let it go. Like most people, they get flipped off driving to work, and they're mad at this stranger for 6 hours. They don't even know it. And it happens a lot with flooding with spouses. We talk a lot with spouses where there's a flooding response. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the work with Gottman. In the marriage lab, that talks about, you know, it's a 3-to-1 ratio or a 4-to-1 ratio where you make 4 positive comments for every negative one in the first couple of minutes you're with someone, or you have what's called a hostile startup, and the person will actually physiologically flood. And men take a long time to come down from flooding physiologically when they feel threatened because, again, you're dealing with a biological fact. Men's brain's different than a female's brain. And this affects that person's worldview and the way that they feel about themselves, because if they're constantly trying to suppress something, whether it's angry, fear, whatever, they're finding themselves. And and what you're saying is that there's sort of an underpinning to this, and I guess maybe being in the field as long as you've been and seeing as many different versions of this story, what's the one thing you could say to just start people out and say, okay, I want to get to the point where I feel not so much I'm in control of the universe, because that's what those attraction people talk about. They're going to sit at home and they're going to run the red lights on the main street, you know, with their consciousness, and meanwhile they can't, you know, maintain a job or a relationship. How do you get someone who feels utterly powerless almost out of control in the sense that their life is just a downward spiral. And they have a hard time even communicating with themselves, let alone other people, to realize that that is just an aftermath. That is just a result of living outside of their strength for years and years. And that their true strength is beneath that, is within that. How do you get them to tap into something when they're in this cascade of just constant negativity? How do you get them to stop the insanity?
Well, there's three components that I support people with, and these are the three parts of what I call the self-esteem system. The first is healing and completing your past so that you're no longer run by the emotions that triggered you when you were a little child when something traumatic happened to you, and then you created evidence for the rest of your life to reinforce whatever it is that you made up about yourself and about other people that keeps you in that downward spiral. So the first thing is to own your own life and your own ability to either react or not react in choice, so that you're not on rails to react no matter what happens and it's invisible. You know, you're the angry person that everywhere you go you're getting into a fight with someone. You're the depressed person that looks for reasons to be depressed about everything, and so you're constantly looking for drugs to get out of the depression because you're just so addicted to that state of sadness that you constantly scan for reasons to become sad, or you constantly are in fear. So everything is a source of worry. Everything is something that is a threat to you. So you live your life scanning from, this could happen to me, I could lose my job, my wife could leave me, my dog could die. You know, everything is a constant possible threat to you. So the first thing to do is to get to the source of what runs you. And if you can't remember the traumatic episode where you can clean it up and you could reinterpret whatever it is that you made up about yourself that doesn't support you, and reinterpret whatever you made up about other people that doesn't support you, like, you know, I'm not good with people, people don't like me, I don't belong, whatever that is that you made up, you can reinterpret it in a way that you can now start to live from a declaration of who you are. And what I mean by that is we all live from evidence, and we create the evidence as a self-fulfilling prophecy because we made something up about ourselves, and then we scan for reasons why it's so. And we actually create those reasons because, you know, we made up that people don't like us. So, for example, we withdraw from people. We're not very friendly. We're not social. We don't make friends. And then we get to be right about it all, and then we get to feel sorry for ourselves, and then we get to tell other people, I told you so, that I wasn't good with people, or whatever that is that we made up. So I'm kind of getting off here a little bit, but...
No, it's okay. I'm following you. I'm actually following you, which is strange, but okay.
So you complete and heal your past, first of all. Second,
right.
You assess what's present now. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are your values? Are they being honored or dishonored? You know, where's your life working, and where is it not working, that there's something missing that could be put into place to have it work more optimally? So you take a look at what are your gifts, your strengths, you could declare your life purpose, for example, out of pursuing a passion. All of these things are basically an inventory about where you are, so that now what you can do is you can go to the third area, which is to create a vision for your life. And that vision is an ideal life where you get to step into that declaration of who you are. So instead of being a shy, introverted person who hates people, you're a charismatic, inspirational person who makes friends easily, as an example. You step
into
that.
That's a pretty radical shift, though. How many people actually go through that big of a shift?
Well, I did.
You did. You were shy. As a dentist, you were shy?
Totally. Totally. I would take my continuing education courses through the mail because I'd be petrified to go and speak to people I didn't know at a seminar.
So what bus did you lose then? How did you get past those first two steps to get to this vision of being this gregarious three-step process? Okay.
Yeah, I decided that what I made up about myself early on didn't support me.
Mm-hmm.
I created new evidence to support the new reinvention, the interpretation that I was good with people, that I was charismatic, that I could be inspirational when I didn't think I was. And I started stepping into that. So I said, okay, if I'm inspirational now, what can I say to this person to inspire them? If I'm charismatic, can I take an interest in what it's like in their world instead of being just so concerned and so enveloped in my own world?
Was the law of attraction involved in any of this transformation? Because that sounds like basically going from being left-handed to being right-handed. I mean, it's very extreme. How did you convince yourself that this was true?
Well, it's the law of attraction is, to put it into real terms for me,
yeah.
It's about you make large whatever you focus on.
Okay.
So if you believe that your future will be better than your present, self-motivation is created where you expect it to be better, so you're in action to create that vision, to create that expectation. And the opposite is true, too. If you expect to fail, if you expect to be poor, if you expect to lose your job, you sabotage, you self-sabotage in a way where you create that expectation. So you attract things that are consistent with your expectation, and that's what you attract. And, you know, it's not airy-fairy woo-woo stuff. It's you actually bring it about on purpose as a self-fulfilling prophecy because you believe it.
But I'm saying that your worldview was shy person, withdrawn,
yep.
And you internalized a completely, it would be almost like changing political parties in a sense, that you would have a completely different worldview and you would start stumping for the other side out of the blue. And what we've seen with some of the authors we had on here that talk about these radical shifts in I would just call it human potential, just to give it kind of a label, is that there's usually a triggering event. There's either a triggering positive event or a triggering negative event that allows them to see a different angle on things. Did you have one that you said, I'm going to quit this dentist job, I'm going to go do this other stuff? What was your triggering event?
Well, it was through a year-long personal development program where I got in touch with what it was costing me. And I had a rigorous coach who, you know, basically ripped me up and down and let me see that I made up all this stuff about myself. I was incredibly arrogant. I kept people away. And I got to see what other people saw about me, and I got to see it did support me. So I, on purpose, made a decision to see the world differently, to act out of a commitment. I like to compare it to you're walking down a road, and there's a fork in the road. And to the left-hand fork is what you've always done. It's what's convenient to you. It's stepping over things. It's acting in ways that that keep you safe but without a concern for other people, let's say. And then on the other fork is acting out of your commitment as opposed to what's convenient, acting out of that new declaration as opposed to the evidence that you developed that said, well, that's just the way I am. I'm not going to change, and there's nothing I can do about it. So what you do is you start to recognize opportunities where you can take the right-hand path as opposed to the left-hand path. And the more you do it, the more it becomes a habit until over time, that's how you reinvent yourself. It's slow at first. You take baby steps. You fall. It's like riding a bike where at first you fall back and forth. You wobble all over the place. But until you develop the distinction of balance, which allows you to ride the bike, you're lousy at riding the bike. It's the same here. The more you experiment with the distinctions or the foundational principles that allow you to be powerful in any of these domains, once you get them and they get you so that you now have balance in riding the bike, you're a great bike rider. And it's
right.
The same thing with our lives. We can reinvent our lives that way.
Well, it just sounds like you're talking about the old learning curve thing where you start off unconsciously incompetent. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of excitement that kind of oscillates through. Because you're in a new world, literally, it's like going to a new city or something like that. And if you can get past that first block of the fear, which is there to protect you, inhibit you, and make you kind of discern, then the excitement goes, okay, let's go to the next level. And then you hit that dip where there's a lot of confusion and frustration, that conscious incompetence, where you're no longer able to go back where you were and you're not where you want to be yet. How long were you in that gap between, you know, dental success and personal development guru? How long were you in the gap between those two worlds?
Well, it was a gradual process, but I would say probably 2 to 3 years. Where,
wow, that's
you know,
good.
Yeah, well, I started out taking a year-long program where I was coached. After that, I learned to coach, and I was continually coached. So the whole coaching process for me was about 9 years. And you know, it's the sort of thing that you get a little at a time, but after a while it becomes easy and you develop habits and you become competent at it and you get things that you don't even have to think about, whereas before when you were first doing them, you'd have to be conscious, okay, you know, let me ask more questions so that this person can talk as opposed to talking more than them. And you have mm-hmm. to take those baby steps to remind yourself in the areas that you want to develop. And coming from a scientific background, it really helped me because I used the science model to create structures to support myself so that I could teach those structures to other people.
And again, how did you get, like you're there with your dental clients during the day, you're drinking and all this personal growth stuff at night, you're dealing with the coach, I mean, there's a lot of plates spinning here. How did you face the fact that you had to basically leave dentistry, this thing that you spent a good, you know, chunk of your life on, to go pursue this other dream?
Well, I didn't do it cold turkey. When I started, I was practicing 5.5 days a week, and I entered into this year-long personal development program with the idea that I would replace my income as a dentist, which took 18 months.
But you knew you were going to quit when you started.
I'm sorry?
You knew you were going to quit being a dentist when you started the program.
Let's put it this way. I wanted to quit, but at first I didn't have a whole lot of faith in my ability to do this. But through the help of coaches and through learning these principles, I started taking baby steps. I mean, remember, in 1991, I hadn't written more than an essay in college, and I didn't really think I could write. I knew I couldn't speak. I couldn't coach. So all of these things that I've stepped into were possibilities that I found. Some of them I had a gift for, like writing, that I didn't really know I had. And, you know, they kind of evolved, where at first I could write nonfiction, but I couldn't write fiction. And then I started writing fiction, and I found out I had a knack for that, although I didn't know I had a knack for it until I did it. So
this is all pre-internet. Right?
Yeah, this is, 1991.
It's before there were blogs, ladies and gentlemen. The dinosaurs roamed the earth. People had to fax things to each other.
Yeah,
wow.
Before fax machines.
Before fax machines? Joe existed before fax machines, lady. I submit to you, ambassador to the past. Well, this is the part that we like to talk about, because everyone talks about what happens at the finish line, where you could sit there and thank, you know, everything from Jesus to Pet Rocks for your success. But the process you went through was not a straightforward A to B type of thing. There was a lot of stuff that came in, you know, from hither, thither, and yon to kind of, like, open you up. And some people break down, some people break open. And you sort of went into this process almost open-ended, almost as if you didn't know what was going to happen. You knew you wanted change. And that's where I get a lot of people that call the show, listen to the show, write the show, throw rocks at the show, is that it begins with this sort of sense of unrest. And that there's a discontentment, that there's like, this is okay, but there's something over the hill I need to go check out. And how many people were in your life, in your dental life, and then on the other side of the rainbow, in this life you've constructed for yourself, how many of those people that were there faded away, just left the scene, and they weren't around when you were now what you are now?
Well,
is it a big migration out, and a whole bunch of new people came in, or the people you knew from high school are with you now, or was there a continuity or no?
Of course, you're going to meet a whole new realm of people, and a lot of the people that I call friends now are into personal development, and they're champion other people's lives, and we share that in common, and I meet them because I hang around those circles now. Whereas before, I was with a whole different crowd. And really, no crowd, because I guess.
Well, finally, you were shy. You were going home, and yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it must be a radical shift for you in terms of. You still there?
Sure.
Go? Okay,
yep,
I heard a noise. Okay. It must be a radical shift for you, almost like that turn that the bus made in the movie Speed, where you went from basically getting up, going to work, seeing your clients, going home, very introspective, very withdrawn, to hanging out with Tony Robbins and the chicken soup guy. Right?
Well, kind of. I mean,
it
didn't happen right
sure.
away, but I had to develop relationships with a lot of these people, and part of what I did was I wrote these books and I developed these programs, and now nobody heard of me, right? So I had to start developing relationships with people that had audiences. So I learned how to do that. I learned how to do joint ventures with people. I learned how to support other people so that they'd want to support me. And the whole thing just kind of mushrooms after a while. You reach a critical mass where you start to get known and people, you know, see some value in what you're saying, and so they tell someone else. And before you know it, you know, you've stepped into that thing that originally was a possibility that I first doubted I could ever do, and then it was a possibility that I hoped I could do, but I didn't think I could do. And before long, it becomes an expectation that's inevitable, and that's when it manifests.
Now, we've been saturated in self-help for about 30 years now. How do you get the person that's done 6, 7, 8, 10 different programs? They've done the chicken soup. They've done the Tony Robbins Walk the Fire. They've done all this stuff, and they're still sitting there going, nothing. And then here comes Dr. Joe, and he's got all these distinctions for him, and he's got it's like they're exhausted. How do you get people who basically tried this passionately, maybe invested their last dime in some of these things, to go up the mat one more time with you?
Well, you have to get to the source of what's keeping them stuck and small and suffering. And until you get to the source, they're just kind of doing a little bit more of the same. They're not really having those extreme breakthroughs because you haven't really got to what's keeping them stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what supported me tremendously was I had some great coaches, and I learned to coach other people so that I could get to what the root of the problem was. So for some people, it's because they made something up about themselves or they made something up about other people. For others, it's, let's put it this way. For most people, it comes down to some lack of belief in themselves, lack of belief in one of those six areas that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why self-esteem, you know, I decided to have that be my focus, because it's really at the source of just about all of the ills in society. Everything from divorce to war, everything from poverty to alcoholism, everything, you know, you name it. If you get to the root of it, it's usually that someone either doesn't believe in themselves, they don't believe in their ability to have rich, meaningful relationships, they don't believe in their ability to create abundance in their life, so they have to resort to other means to do it, like stealing or cheating or whatever. So if you can elevate someone's self-esteem, and it's not in the traditional self where many people think it's ego. It's not ego at all. As a matter of fact, someone with high self-esteem has very little ego running their lives because they have as strong an appreciation for what it's like for other people as they do for themselves. So they create win-win relationships. It's they don't misuse their relationships where they take advantage of people so that they can get ahead, because they have an appreciation for the fact that as long as you don't honor someone else, it's going to come back to you tenfold. So you have to have an appreciation where you can champion other people if you want to be championed. You have to love other people if you want to attract love. You have to be generous with your time or with whatever you have if you want to attract things into your life. So.
Well, let's take one of these obstacles on, because it's pretty prominent right now. It's let's look at money, because there's so many people that walk around with a poverty complex. Let's just get psychological here for a minute, as Dr. Val just sprawls out on the couch for us there. the poverty complex thing is, and we'll just give an example with somatics. I was up in Northampton last week in Massachusetts, a lovely little town, and visited my friends up there at the Somatic Systems Institute. And they're in a nice little office there at a side street there, a Masonic Street in downtown Northampton. And the classes are $14. And, you know, everything is done sort of like it's the 1850s. It's very strange.
Yep.
Where if you go just down the road to Capallo over in Lenox, there are women paying $500 for a weekend of yoga.
It is
bizarre to me that down the road in Rhinebeck, New York, over in Omega, they're paying $1,000 to see the likes of, Richard Bartlett knock them on their butt doing matrix energetics, because he's the quantum guy. And he comes with many frequencies, and he's going to lift their consciousness, and they're going to see, Jehovah, Jesus, and Buddha all in one day. So it's all this state chasing from Northampton, where everybody's mellow, and it's $14, and you come and you move and you learn and you leave, to Lenox, where you have some type of downward dog epiphany, to over in Rhinebeck, where you're going to basically go to the other side of the cosmos and see the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. How do you get people who have this poverty complex, who either are the ones delivering the information, as in the Semantics case, or the people that are receiving the information, as in the matrix energetics, quantum kind of soup, where they're going to every seminar, every consciousness raising kind of thing? How do you get people to center about money, understand what money means, understand how it's a reflection of their self-esteem?
Well, it's not only a reflection of their self-esteem, but it's an energy. It reflects the ability to contribute value in the world. And so people that lack it either don't believe that they offer much value, or they haven't convinced other people that they offer much value.
Second one.
So
how do you get the second one? First one I could scratch out. The second one is the one that's a mystery.
How do you convince other people?
Yes.
Well, first of all, you have to believe that you have value yourself before others can believe in you. And
I'm there.
You have to create value for people in how you speak what you're offering them. You have to create benefits that they want, that they, one, appreciate that there's something in it for them, and they want that. So, you hear about, oh, the economy's terrible and so many people are doing poorly, and, that whole thing becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where the opposite happens. People believe that poverty is inevitable. They believe that suffering is around the corner. They believe that there's no way that you can prosper. And so what they do is they pull back. They stop taking risks. Now, intelligent risks. They stop doing things that would create the opposite of abundance. And so then they get to be right about it, and they get to complain, and they get to feel sorry for themselves, and they get to have other people commiserate with them. And so, it's really a very insidious sort of thing. And the opposite is true, too. I mean, right now, there will be more people creating massive wealth in this economy, just like there was during the Great Depression. It's not that everyone needs to buy into it. If you believe that you have value, you look for ways to manifest it with creativity, belief in what you have to offer. You structure it in a way where people can understand it and want it. You can be very successful in this economy.
Yeah, because this is one of the things that I was up at the with the Snowflake Cast conference last week with a bunch of eggheads, and a lot of the talk was about the economy in terms of nonlinear dynamics, which looks at systems thinking, things like that. And the economist said that basically the market's run by two emotions, fear and greed. We had greed for a while, and now we have fear. And when you have fear, you have inhibition. You have people unwilling to, like you said, take risks. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it becomes difficult for things to change because everybody's kind of in this emotional gridlock. And one of the things that you have, I think it was about, 50 distinctions, you say, that are the platform for personal reinvention. We wanted to get to give us, just a short list, maybe 5 or 10 things that people could think about as they face this, because there's a lot of people walking around right now living on eggshells, let alone walking on them, when it comes to dealing with, their financial, their fragile financial consciousness, I would say, which might not translate to the actual state, but they feel that way. So what's 10 distinctions or 5 that you can give us to kind of just get out of the rut?
Well, let me start with the first part of raising your self-esteem. There are 3 key distinctions there. The first is empathy. What is it like in the other person's world that would have them say or do whatever it is that they say or do? And that allows you not to be at the effect of their words or their actions. So empathy also allows you to be personally powerful in spite of what it's like in the world, in spite of what it's like with people ranting and raving around you or being depressed around you or worrying about the economy or whatever. When you can have empathy and you can appreciate what it's like for them without getting sucked into it, that's the whole thing. So that you're no longer contingent upon other people's states of mind, but you have an appreciation for what they are. So you can be powerful in any environment. The second is gratitude. We're very good at invalidating ourselves, and we're very good at looking for the flaw, both in ourselves and in other people. but we're not very good at acknowledging ourselves for things that we do well. We're not very good at acknowledging other people for things that they are as a contribution. So one of the keys to creating the abundance is not only to be grateful for what you have, but to start seeing possibilities for yourself and for others that you don't see or that they don't see right away. So you see things as a possibility that you now start to champion other people to step into. So, you know, I might, if you know, we're talking in a bar, I might say things to you like, you know, you're a funny guy, Mark, and, you know, you have a lot of charisma. And, you know, maybe I think that you're boring as can be and that you have none. But what I'm doing is I'm giving you a possibility. Now you start to feel better about yourself. So maybe you're a little looser. You know, you start to tell a joke. You start to come out of yourself out of my championing you in a way where I saw something that maybe you didn't see in yourself. And you can do that same thing with yourself. You can start acknowledging yourself for something on a daily basis where you start to feel better about who you are and you start to expect more things, more good things, because you start to accentuate the positive and you start to minimize the negative.
Is that under the fake it till you make it cybernetics?
It's not faking it at all, because what you're doing is you're actually stepping into it. You're becoming that person. You're not faking it. See, you're only faking it if you don't believe that that's who you are. So, for example, if I'm introverted and if I'm bad socially and if I can't make friends and I go and I start faking it, I'm going to be false and inauthentic. Are you dying?
Yeah, okay, I'm back.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
Yeah,
so,
I heard you there.
If
oh man, that was like
is
one
a
of those
dog in the back?
it just started and kept going.
Okay.
But I,
okay.
I get what you're saying in a nutshell, that people have a lot of fixed attitudes about themselves based on their past. But when you're dealing with change and flux and that unpredictable thing called the future, mm-hmm. most people fear unknown misery more than known misery.
Yes.
You know, and that's why you see people go from the therapist to the you know, the conscious raising seminar, and they read the self-help book, and they think, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, and nothing's changing, because they haven't really gotten...
All right, that's it. He's fired.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
No,
yeah,
okay.
Please.
I'm back. It's gone. They haven't really gotten past that threshold internally where they actually believe all this stuff. They think a lot of it
yep.
is window dressing.
Yep.
And like you said, their attitude hasn't really shifted. So they
yep.
don't have possibility in their heart. They have necessity in their heart. It's I need to change, but I don't think it's possible to change.
Yes.
And getting across that bridge is something that I would say a large share of the people that go to these programs, they never make that distinction. So you're saying that a lot of this stuff is sort of flying in the ethers. It's something that's a fine-tuning, that if they knew that up front, probably not as, you know, not that there's going to be that much less work to do, but the work will be progressive rather than this meandering that goes on. People just fall between the cracks. And again, they're doing everything they say. They're going to the seminar, they're doing this, and it's like it doesn't all fit together because there's no glue for it. You're saying the glue is this sort of systemic awareness that what I thought it was is not what it is. But basically challenging their assumptions about their past, challenging their assumptions about their present, and then making some new assumptions about their future as a combo, not as a three-part set, but as a rhythm, as something that they could actually... Well, they did it. I always tell people, you already made these things. You just didn't give any credit for it. When you went from crawling to walking... It wasn't like you had to go to some shrink to talk, oh, you know, I keep falling down, and, you know. You just kept doing it, and you got there. Same thing happened all the way through life. But somehow, when you get past the age of 25, there's not a lot of guidance. There's a lot of gremlins and a lot of ghouls and a lot of people taking advantage of your weak spots. But there's not a lot of guidance. You found a lot of guidance. I would submit to you that probably 8 out of 10 people out there going through similar career change, life change, they search for their guidance. They don't always get it. And what you were saying before about stuff about money was really resonating, because like we're offering something on this show every week to get authors like yourself, people like yourself in their ear, because they don't normally hear people like this
tell them their backstory. They hear the fun story. They hear the, way, I got all the solutions. They don't hear that you were a shy dentist.
Yep.
That might be them. That would be a shy office worker or a shy, you know, mother of three, you know. They don't understand that that surface image, that persona that they've been living in isn't them, that they're infinitely able to go inside and pull out another version of themselves. They're sentient beings, as I was pontificating up there in Springfield last week. And because you're a sentient being, there's no limit. And that is something I think that's missing from a lot of the psychology and a lot of the pop culture stuff, because they make you into a category, they make you into a label, and then they track you that way. And unfortunately, people buy it because it's simple, it's easy, it fits, and there's no thinking involved. And we always say on the show, ouch, I'm thinking. As people go, oh, my God, ouch, I'm thinking. The wood's burning. And your stuff seems to be much more along the lines of a lot of reflective work, a lot of looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, you know, this assumption I made about myself didn't have any context. So it doesn't have any context. It's basically just kind of a false god. I don't have to obey this god anymore. And you didn't obey the shy god. You didn't obey the god that says I can't be a public speaker. You defied all those false gods, and then you found your truth, and they are. And it's like, it's always, I want to get someone just once that's between the dentist and the guru, and I can talk to them right in the middle, and they're in the kiln, and go, what's going on now? But that's like talking to the caterpillar when he's becoming a butterfly. I guess he's busy. You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's also, one of the things that you ask, I want to speak to, and that is, you know, why do some people go through all the courses, and, you know, they learn all the information, and nothing changes? Well, as long as it's information, information alone is not the access to power. Really, having the distinction of what translates where you apply the information. So, you know, what makes someone a good swimmer? It's not the fact that you put your arms over your head and you put, you know, your head at this angle. You have to get in the pool and you have to learn the whole rhythm of swimming. And the same for that example that I gave you of riding the bike. It's you could go to the library and you could look up what a bike is, and you could see that it has two pedals and it has a handlebar and it has a chain, and you know, you could learn that, okay, I have to put my right foot on the right pedal and move it in a circular motion, and it's all information. But until you actually fall side by side and you wobble a bit and you fall and you get back on the bike, you haven't got what it is to ride the bike. Until you actually swim, you know, and you get the motions and you put them all together, or you do gymnastics or whatever that is in any domain to make you powerful, that's when you get it, and that's when things change. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, once you are in the process, if you take the interpretation that there are nothing but opportunities out there and every problem holds a gift, what happens is you start having serendipitous things occur in your life where you wouldn't even recognize them before, but now they become opportunities because you're in development. You're looking for them. You're acting on them. You don't let them invalidate you. You don't run from them or hide from them. So all of that, you know, there's a million different factors working at one time that allows you to end up being powerful. And the bottom line is, you have to enjoy the process. You have to be willing to fall. If you're ever going to ride the bike, you have to be willing to swallow a little water if you're ever going to learn to swim. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah, like I said, I think a lot of the stuff you say is it's patently obvious, but it's also kind of elusive because it doesn't sit still. I you know, sometimes we say on the show, the truth is a gypsy. You know, it's always moving. And your search for it is unique from what I'm hearing here, because it doesn't involve one path to it. It's sort of having a set of principles or like you say, these distinctions that you grow an affinity for over time, because the more you make them, of course, the more it grounds you, the more it sort of centers you and doesn't allow you to go off on the anger train or the fear bus, you know, and hide from your own truth and hide from your own future, really. And, you know, so I think I kind of understand where you're getting at now, with sort of self-esteem as a personal reinvention. Like you're saying, this is a different animal, and it involves doing not so much. I'm not gonna call it a lot of work, but it isn't a little work. It's somewhere in the middle. It's one of those things where it's like, it isn't gonna happen automatically. Like, we're not gonna read the secret book and stare at the wall and all the money's gonna come rushing in the door. I can't stand those people. But anyway, I'm kvetching. So once again, why don't you recap the offer you're making to the listeners? If they made it this far, Dr. Joe's got a gift for you, so why don't we just recap with that?
Sure. If you visit www.selfesteemsystem.com, selfesteemsystem.com, you'll receive a 45-minute audio called Seven Steps to Soaring Self-Esteem, plus a membership that's worth $129. You get it free in our Success Club, and that is just for a thank you for checking out the work that we do. And you'll see as you sign up for those freebies, you'll also get to look at a page that shows you the three self-esteem system packs that we offer. And, you know, if it rings a bell and your intuition tells you that it's something that can serve you, then we'd have you take a look at that. And if not, just enjoy the freebies and appreciate you listening to me and Val and Mark this evening.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for joining us here again.
Thanks a lot.
The Center for Personal Reinvention.com is the main site. Dr. Joe Rubino, a former dentist and a shy man, now a influential guru of the personal development vernacular, and you really danced on a volcano with us tonight. It was a kind of a lively show, but you know, you made it this far. So you guys can listen back on the on demand, and we thank you for joining us here on Summertime. We'll have you on again.
Well, thank you, Mark and Val, and everyone else. Appreciate your support tonight.
Thanks, all Doc. Right. See ya.
Yep.
Take care.
Night.
All right, I gotta do something here. Hang on. Yes.
Jeez.
I almost died on the air. That was great. Well,
I thought you were hacking up a testicle.
Not that anyone listens. Yeah, I could have been. I used the Heimlich there from the dentist. But that was intense, man. I just started off as a giggle, and then it was like one eye started tearing, then a nostril starts draining. I'm like, this is it. I'm gonna have a heart attack on the air. And then it'll be recorded.
Not good.
Yeah.
I'm a pirate!
That's right.
A hacking pirate.
Yeah, that's right.
Listen,
wait, we got to play this because it's just, you know, this is a tribute to everyone out there who's still probably at Buffalo Wild Wings sitting at the bar.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
Yeah, I saw a couple of those guys over there. So, yeah, we learned a lot about the self-esteem tapes. They are unique. I mean, if we can line them all up, Heather, this guy, the other guy we had a couple weeks ago, they're like ferrets for positivity.
Mm.
I need a ferret for positivity because, you know.
I have a ferret.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know.
Her name is Lola.
I don't know how positive it is, though.
It's very positive. She's very sweet.
It's upbeat.
She's sweet and she's cute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's tomorrow. And that is it for us today.
I watched him for 5 minutes last night after the Obama talk, and he was like, President Obama was boring. It was this big
beat. Can you imagine the balls?
Can you imagine? Yeah, it was great. He was boring. He was acting like an academic. He was talking over our heads.
Oh,
you
smart?
The people.
I see. He'd rather listen to the other moron?
I'm saying to myself, if that's your biggest problem with what he said, you really need to just put down the microphone and walk home. Just walk on. I did everything on Fox. Then he goes, let's turn to some analysis. Here's Karl Rove. You gotta be kidding me. They got another indictment.
You filthy criminals.
God.
Can't stand it. So, you know, the self-esteem thing goes both directions because one of the things that we didn't get into with Dr. Joe is the role of the surroundings on the self. Now, he has the capacity to, I don't know if it's ignore them, but not give them as much credit, because a lot of these guys in the, you know, the self-esteem industry, they teach the person to go internal, but in their head internal, and to just cancel out all that stuff. And like he says, everything in your past that isn't serving you is a false god. Just forget about it. Well, it's not easy to do when your body feels that way. So it's like they don't understand how surroundings isn't just about the outside world, it's also about the inside world. It's what surrounds your mind is what environment really means. Environment. Ment is mind. Environment means to surround. So that's why if you're a philo and you're dealing with a crushing relationship issue, ain't no self-esteem guru going to get you out of that soup anytime quick. You have to go through the pain, all the pain, of loss. And that's what a lot of growth involves. Loss.
you're going to lose a bunch of things. So I asked him how many safes left his life when he went from, you know, Joe Dentist to Joe Guru. And, you know, there's a paper trail there, and he meets a different set of people. And a lot of times when you're going through this car wash called life, people are going to bop in and out of your life, and you can't get attached to it because they're just extensions of you, living mirrors even. Oh, I'm going off on a rant, and it's 10:11.
Yeah, I'm about to knock you in your testicles.
Well, next week we will be joining you, Sapiens, from high atop the Rocky Mountains as your erstwhile host journeys westward as a middle-aged man to get his brains beat in at the Society for Research and Adult Development. On Thursday, April 2nd, which you can check out on somerspace.org/somerday.html. Please claim a seat so I can get a plane ride home and have some fun and teach you guys some Soma.
When are you leaving?
That'll be Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock on the JetBlue.
Really?
Yes.
It snuck up on me.
What, the leaving?
Yeah.
I have to leave to go back. That's kind of the run. Then Wednesday, doing the show live from Denver in the post-mortem of the SROD conference, when I will be PhD'd woodpecker to death at that point. I'm in the whole person development group that day. So you can check that out. I'll be blogging about it on the Blog Soma, the blog we love, blogsoma.net. Not the blog we hate. We've killed that off. A long time ago, thedailyprofile.com is gone. Gone, gone, but there's still some things over there.
And you know what else is gone? Me. We have to hang up now. I'm 13
Wait.
Minutes past bedtime.
All right, well, hang on a second here. We have to just do something
see,
for
you.
For,
do you people witness how he tortures me?
Something for Dr. Joe. It's past. There we go. Just listen to this. We will see you next week. Travel light. I will talk to you from the mountaintop next Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. Until then.
And be on time, damn it.
What?
Be on time next week.
Yeah, I'll try.
Thanks.
Travel light. And listen to this. Don't you hang up now.
You'll find a way to make your natural tendencies pay. You'll be a dentist. You have a talent for causing pain. Come be a dentist. People will pay you to be inhumane. Your temperament's wrong for the preacher. And teaching would suit you still. Come be a dentist. You'll be a success. Here he is, folks, the leader of the black. What the fuck up that gas? Oh my god! He's the special good. Who wants that pizza by the Marquis de Sade? Oh, that hurt! Wait, I'm not numb! Shut up. Open wide. Here I come! I'm your dentist. And I enjoy the career that I picked. I'm your dentist. And I get off on the pain I inflict. I drill when I drill a bicuspid. It's well, though they tell me I'm maladjusted. And though it may cause my patients distress, somewhere, trouble above me, I know that my mom is proud of me. Cause I'm a dentist and the sick. Say ah. Say ah. Say ah. Now spit. There you go. Travel light, Dr. Joe. Good night, everybody.